Hey, you're listening to Rock and or Roll, part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. I'm BJ, and on this episode, we're going to continue with the Power Pop series. For this episode, you're going to hear interviews I conducted with Brent Hoad, who was in a Kansas City power pop band called The Secrets with an asterisk, and they released one self-titled album on a label called Wi-Fi, and that record came out in 1982. And then we're going to hear from Jeff Root from a Boston band called Hot Dates, who released a great self-titled power pop album. And I think it's interesting to hear the stories of bands like these, how these bands came together, how they ended up performing this style of music, how they managed to get a record out. And these are two high-quality, well-produced, well-written, well-performed records that were released basically independently. But both of these records by both of these bands stand right up there with any of the other high-quality power pop albums from this era. So I hope you enjoy this episode about The Secrets and Hot Dates. Well, so how did the Secrets begin? How did it all get started?
There's a guy named Gary Apple who lives here in town, and he had been kind of a country rock singer. He had a record deal with Mercury, which existed at the time, from Nashville. So they wanted him to tour, and so he had to put together a band. I can't remember how I met him, but I think it was through a drummer who was the original guy who joined that band. But I think he lasted maybe one or two gigs. We opened for Patti Smith at the Uptown, and we bought her a big bouquet of roses, actually. She was just sweet as can be. So he had to put this band together, so we got me... I think Norm joined after the second gig, maybe. And then Kevin Davis, who was the lead guitar player for a long time. Who else do we have? Oh, we had Pat Tomic on the drums. So we went on a tour the record company paid for, and we had a pretty big motor home, and they sent us up and down the East Coast. And then I think the tour budget ran out. So we stopped getting our salary. So we just got together and think, hey, you know, we could have a real nice little self-contained four-piece here. Start recording in Norm's garage. It's right around the corner from BB's lawn side, which was dangerous. So we started working up songs, covers and originals, started coming in with some originals. And
is this like the mid-70s?
No, this is like, it would have been like 77.
Okay.
78.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere around there, late 70s. Had a couple of wannabe booking agents start getting us gigs. And we got good, you know. And Titan, we'd always known those guys for a long time because they were fans of Millionaire at Midnight. That was the band I was in before
that. Right.
That was a crazy band. We were kind of like the Tubes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had extras and props and stuff like that. But by the time the gig was over, the club was just a mess. You know, Cheerios all over the floor and wiffle ball golf balls I would hit out in the crowd, you know. we kind of got on that circuit that we'd had before. Shortly after that, we did a deal with Titan and started recording. Those two that are on the single, I think maybe we recorded two other ones at the same time, and I can't remember which ones. But those guys did a pretty good job of promoting stuff locally, you know, getting reviews and, you know, like Trouser Press, KC Star, you know, all that stuff. You know, people bought that single, probably had a trunk load of them somewhere in somebody's car, selling the gigs and got some radio play. College radio play. KU, UMKC, Manhattan, Wichita. One of our songs, it was off the album, it went to number 9 in Wichita. That was our claim to fame, you know? Mm-hmm. And here's a good story. This would have been about 1979, I guess. We opened two shows for Pat Benatar, because our managers at the time also booked concerts. So they had us open at the Uptown Forum and in some place in Wichita. The Uptown show was the first one. So we played that show. A couple days later, we go to Wichita and play the other gig. Come back home. About 2 or 3 days later, the Wichita Police Department calls our office. Some woman had been raped. She called the police and told her these guys, it happened in a van, I guess, told the police that these guys had done this, and they told them they were the secrets. They told her they were the secrets. So anyway, I was in the office when they called, or I called them back or something. They said the date of this event, and that was the date we were playing at the Uptown. So we had an alibi, you know, because yeah. It was at night, you know. And so I hope they caught the guys. But anyway, that tells you how famous we were in Wichita, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't know if these guys knew who we were or just grabbed the name out of a newspaper or something like that. Yeah, we did that one bar down there, the Coyote Club. We played there every 6 weeks for 6 years, 4 nights a week. And like Wednesday and Thursday were dead. So we would work up new material and stuff on those nights. And then by the weekend, we were exhausted, but that was when it was packed. A lot of kind of fun, weird memories from that time.
Yeah.
Let me see. What else can I tell you? Guy that owned this label called Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
You know, as in why. Yeah. English guy, Paul, forgot his last name. Really nice guy. He came to see his play. He came all the way over to see his play live down in Pittsburgh, Kansas. He was so thrilled to be able to walk out on the street and stand on Route 66. Mm-hmm. You know, it goes across the very little corner of Kansas. But anyway, we played, and the next day he made us an offer. And he knew Greg Penny, the guy who did the Ricky Lee Jones records and so forth, and called and offered him the job of producing. And he said, well, I've been working with Stan Lynch. Why don't we do it together? You know, shortly after that, the Heartbreakers played at Municipal Auditorium, and we went down and we had lunch with Stan, and then we went to the gig that night and went to kind of a wild party across the street at the Holiday Inn, and afterwards hung out with the band and all that. And we already had the deal then. We were just schmoozing. So that's how we got to know each other. The chemistry was good, and we had fun. Pinball machine in the studio, or a video game. Astro Blaster or something like that, the old one. So that's how we got to know each other. I saw Stan a couple of times when I moved out there. But they were really on the road a lot, and so I didn't really get to hang with him much out there. I saw him more, of course, when we were in the studio.
And you recorded in L.A., you said, right?
Yeah, our secret stuff we did, except for the stuff we did at Chuck Chapman's.
Mm-hmm. I never even knew of anything else that was on that label, Wi-Fi, but recently I know I saw that at least one of the Sparks records they released probably just in Europe.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Whomp That Sucker, right? Is that the one? Yeah.
That's one of those,
I always love that band. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the Secrets record is, in my opinion, it's really a classic power pop record. But how did you feel? Were you guys happy with how it turned out with the production and everything?
I thought the mix was okay. I wasn't happy with the mastering because I think it got compressed too much. So it didn't crackle like it should have. The Titan stuff was, even though it had less of a budget, it was mastered better. But we didn't take as much time with that in the actual recording. Yeah, I thought the LP was mixed well and good performances, and but the mastering flattened everything out a little bit. No big deal, you know. If it had crackle a little more on the master, it would have sounded better on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Because the radio stations compress their signal a lot so they don't harm their equipment and transmitters and stuff like that. And plus, they all try to make themselves louder than everybody else. So it would have sounded better on the radio if they given it some air and let those radio stations have something to grab, you know, the peaks and stuff like that. If compressors have something to grab, I'm getting kind of weird here, but then your record sounds better coming out of the radio. You got to compress it a little bit, but not much.
Pumping all the buttons almost every day, but now you're gonna hear what I say. If there's any request, I do my best to please you. Once on the hour, I'll bring you all the news. Every 20 minutes is a blast from the past, and I'm really nailing down on the other news. Oh, well, I got a radio home.
Shoot, I thought of something here. KY gave us a real boost. You know, they played our radio, they played our record, and we played on the air, and they interviewed us. And have you heard that KY 102 Homegrown? And oh,
is it one of those compilations? Yeah. Or are you on one of those?
Yeah.
Okay.
The first one. I think Uniform was the, it was on there because they were hitting that pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
there was obviously there were tons of bands for a few years there. There was this whole kind of a power pop craze kind of thing that was going on, obviously.
Yeah.
And I wonder, for a band like you, was there a conscious effort to make a certain kind of record, or was it more organic, or was it a mixture of that?
I think it was just an accident.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was just our tastes coincided, you know, and we all had a history of, you know, listening to the Beatles and the Stones and the Kinks and all that stuff. And that just came out, you know, especially when we started writing stuff. But we play oddball stuff like the Nils Lofgren first solo album stuff.
I love that record. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And what else do we do? That's one of the best ones I can.
Yeah, like I Don't Want to Know and The Sun Hasn't Set on This Boy Yet. Those songs are so great.
Yeah, Keith Don't Go.
Yeah.
Yeah. We did Back It Up.
Yeah. So what happens after your record comes out then? You did the
Much.
Yeah, not much. It didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, what was the label? What did the label even do? I mean, was there much that the label had to offer in terms of promotion and stuff like that?
Well, since everybody that was behind us from RCA was gone.
Yeah.
You know, they'd all gone to other labels or replaced. You know, you got to have somebody that's your champion within the company.
Yeah.
So it was just one of those deals. Happens all the time. Because when we recorded it, we had to wait almost 2 years before they put it out because they changed management and everything, and RCA got bought by someone. So the new people that came in just dragged their feet and they signed Bob Welch or somebody like that. So they gave him, they pushed the button on his and they let our masters sit around. But that's just the way things are. And I'm glad people can make their own records and put them out now, even though they don't get paid. Well, what would you like to know about the history?
I'd like to hear the whole story, whatever you want to tell. I mean, you just cleared something up because you know, one thing that was confusing is why there was a couple of years there between when your single came out, when your record came out, but now you just cleared that up, that it sat there.
We kind of were disillusioned, you know, with the music business, and that kind of the rot set in, you know, because, you know, you do all that work and then somebody lets it on the shelf and you don't own the masters. So you can't sell it to some other label. And when I moved to L.A., I went to see the producer. Greg Penny and Stan Lynch were the producers. Stan Lynch from the Heartbreakers.
Right.
And Greg had done some stuff with Ricky Lee Jones. But he had the master tapes in a closet in his house. And for a while, we were thinking about remixing it, you know, remastering it or something, but never got around to it. And I think he moved because he only lived a few blocks away from me. It was fun recording. You know, Michael Jackson was doing overdubs across the hall. And so we bumped into him quite a bit, and Quincy Jones.
Were they working on Thriller?
I think it was the one before Thriller.
Off the Wall.
What was that one called?
Off the Wall.
Yeah, it would have been Off the Wall.
That probably came out in, I think that came out in 79.
Off the Wall did?
I think so.
I don't know. Was
that would be crazy if they were working on Thriller. What studio were you at?
Westlake. It was on Beverly Boulevard.
Uh-huh.
And there's a restaurant across the street from our hotel, and we would go in there to eat sometimes, and a few times we saw him in there, and he would just get up out of his booth and dance, you know, like he'd have some kind of idea or something. And
uh-huh.
So like it was before all the cool dance moves he was doing, you know. Of course, we weren't really paying attention, but it was insane, you know. He'd jump up and just do a little 30-second dance routine and get back down and just finish his omelet or whatever.
Oh, yeah, it looks like they did Off the Wall all the way up until June of 79, and Westlake is listed on Wikipedia as one of the studios. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe they were in there mixing or something. I don't know what they're doing.
So yeah. Were you recording in 79? Is that when you were recording your record there?
I think it was 80.
80?
Probably 80. Yeah.
Yeah.
It might be on the label or something, but well, heck, it might have been Thriller. There was somebody in there working with him. I don't recall, but I remember they hauled in their own huge console just for mixing headphones. You know, it was bigger than the main console in there that they used to mix. So they're probably just doing overdubs,
or maybe demos, or maybe remixes, or yeah,
could have. You know, you might be right. It might have been just demos.
Yeah.
So, but that's crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had a lot of fun with those guys. You know, we got to hang with the Heartbreakers some, and Stan, of course, great drummer, great guy.
Well, you had a great scene that you were a part of, like with the Boys. I love the Boys and Gary Charlson. And
yeah.
Yeah, it was a...
Yeah. The Boys were from Omaha, I guess, from Nebraska, Lincoln, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I think we played a couple of gigs with him. And, of course, Gary Charlson, we've been pals for a long time. And who's the other guy? Jimmy?
Oh, yeah. I have that. There's that Just Another Pop album record I have, too, that Titan put out.
Okay.
Right? Is that Titan?
Baby Don't Laugh. That's the cool song that he had, and I got to produce that for those guys. So
what do you think of the term power pop? Are you aware of like
power
the,
pop?
Yeah. Are you aware of like the whole cult of power pop fans and everything?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know there's a lot of, I think we've sold a lot of stuff in Japan.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's people that eat that stuff up, you know.
Yeah.
My favorite power pop band was Cheap Trick.
Yeah, that's my favorite band of all time. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm actually writing a book.
Yeah, we get to hang out with those guys a lot. Are you?
You did?
About Cheap Trick?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they used to, we used to play the Blue Note in Columbia a lot. And those guys, if they had a gig around, they would come down and see us after their gig.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we were taking Kinks requests and stuff like that from those guys. The first time I saw them, it was at Memorial Hall, and they opened for the Kinks.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the Kinks, you want to be an opening act, it's tough, open for the Kinks. You know, because Kinks fans hate whatever opening act is there, just taking up time, you know,
mm-hmm.
till the Kinks can come on. But that's one of my favorite bands, too.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my top five.
Yeah, I got into collecting power pop in the 90s, and, you know, back before the internet, it was kind of like you just find shit, you know? And then you find
yeah.
out about it through, I don't know, mm-hmm. I would read old Trouser Press magazines, and so I don't know where I even got the secrets from.
Yeah.
But I remember mm-hmm. I had a friend, I was in Madison, Wisconsin, I had a friend in Minneapolis who would go, if there was something I was looking for, the record stores were better in Minneapolis, and he would go look for me. And I remember I sent him, I said, you know, you got to look for this record by the Secrets.
If she was gonna call, I guess she would have called by 10. And now there's nothing left to do but go and blame it on myself again. Every car down the block and every knock at the door she'll be there. So let's drink your toast and tell me what you've been up to, baby. Won't you just call me up and tell me what went wrong?
Oh, hey, I know what. We did a bunch of stuff with Kim Fowley. You know who he is?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He wrote Alley-Oop.
Mm-hmm.
You know that song?
Yeah.
Anyway, he signed the Runaways.
Yeah.
And he was doing all these cheap-ass record deals with MCA. And so on another trip out there, we did some showcases for him in a rented rehearsal hall in Hollywood. And then we did a couple of gigs down in a bar down on the beach. Made some offer for a $5,000 advance, you know, from MCA. And then it was just one of these deals where he was just making these cheap record deals with MCA. I think the Runaways were on that. He signed them.
So was this after the Wi-Fi thing was over?
No. This was before that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But he made us that offer and we turned him down.
Mm-hmm.
So because he was really weird, he was kind of control freak. Yeah, it looked like Frankenstein kind of.
Yeah.
He wasn't big like Fred Gwynne, but he was tall and skinny.
Yeah.
Kim Fowley, geez, he died a while back. I can't remember when.
Yeah.
But his stage name was Spider Webb.
Mm-hmm.
He's a legend, good or bad, you know.
How did he find out about you? How did you come on his radar?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe he heard the single or he heard a demo of something. Anyway, he calls me at 3:00 in the morning. I think our manager gave my number. He says, "You are the John Fogerty of the 80s. You know, talk about flattery, you know. But, and then we talked for like, or I listened to him talk for like 2 hours. Well, okay. Talk to Marcy, our manager, and she'll do the arrangements and so forth, and we'll come out and see you. So that was that deal. That was the weirdest phone call I've ever had.
Yeah.
Kim Fowley calls you at 3:00 in the morning, you know. I think he took a break in the middle of it. He said, "Hang on, I got to go do my B12 shot." Because he would take a B12 shot every day.
You already had a manager,
because
he also tried to get his hooks in Cheap Trick, so he was always around and he was always trying to insinuate himself with, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Cheap Trick had a manager that. Forgot his name now, and he just worked the piss out of that band.
Yeah, Ken Adamany.
You know, Ken Adamany, yeah. And he overworked him, but it was just tour, you know, and then a week off to do the record, and then back, you know.
Oh, yeah,
I'm glad they survived all that, you know. Great guys, though, really, really cool guys. Midwestern guys from Rockford.
Yeah.
Have you heard that record? It's called Rockford.
I love that record. Yeah, it's great.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah.
Well, so how did The Secrets end then? What was the... How long did you last after the record?
We played about 6 years. I think we played maybe 3 to 4 years after we did the record. Let me see here. Shooting Star, you know those guys?
Yeah.
Their bass player quit, I guess, or semi-retired. and they I got this deal to do a couple of songs for a movie called I'm Up the Creek.
Yeah, Cheap Trick. Cheap Trick did the song, yeah. Up the Creek. Yeah.
They were on it, yeah. And so Shooting Star got the offer to do one or two songs, I guess, and they didn't have a bass player, so they asked Norm to play. So he went out there, and then during that time, they asked him to join. Mm-hmm. And so he came back and said that's the way he wants to go, you know?
Yeah.
And not a bad career move, you know?
I think the one thing I haven't asked you about is the asterisk that you have on the name. Is that, was that your solution because there were other bands called The Secrets, or?
Oh, well, we didn't know that at the time, but what's your problem with the asterisk?
I was just wondering. Well, I know there was an Australian band called The Secrets. I know about at least, but, you know, with names like that back in the 70s and 80s, there was always bands. Yeah, there was lots of bands.
But, right. It's just kind of a head scratcher, conversation starter, you know. It stuck, you know, I guess. It set us apart from those other bands, I believe. But I can't remember how we came up with that crazy idea. But we should put an asterisk after every song on the back, on the track list.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was a fun, you know, you'll see, you've got like the English beat, or you'll have bands that had to add UK to the end of their name, right. Stuff like that. And I thought the asterisk was another solution.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with 2 devices at once, new quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Big billboard of the album on at a Strawberries, which is an old record store in the area,
right
on Boylston, and we were right up next to the Cars, and so we thought it was all going to happen. It was pretty exciting. It was it was a great scene, lots of clubs to play, and audience that was always there. So it was just a great scene at the time.
Yeah, I would like to hear the whole story, the story of how the band formed and how you. Did your sound develop, or was this the kind of band that you started out to be?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. We actually Bob Millett and I, he goes by Rob now, and Grant Clark were all from Littleton. And we had been doing some recordings prior to the Boston scene becoming so vital and happening, and before we actually took a step into it. I guess it was 1978. I moved out of my parents' place, and I went to the place down in Natick because we were spending a lot more time with each other. We thought, well, why don't we pull together a band and try to catch the coattails of all of this new wave stuff that's happening in Boston. And so we put together a band. At the time, I had been working with some comedians, one in particular, a guy named Martin Olson, who was a writer for cartoons like Phineas and Ferb and Rocco's Modern Life. And he and I also grew up in Littleton. And so I had these two interests. There was a guy, and I've forgotten his name, that wanted to put together a show that involved comedy and music. And so the first thing we did was Grant and I pulled together two other guys to get a band together that could actually perform. And then we started working with Stephen Wright, who is the famous stand-up comedian. He had just graduated from the Media College in Boston. So we were an ill-fated comedy music group that performed a couple times at a place called the Spring Street Saloon, which later became the Bing Hall Comedy Club in Cambridge. So anyways, that was how we started in the summer of 78. And then we decided, well, this comedy thing is not working. Why don't we just break away and just do a band? So we decided to kind of hone the arrangements and all to be a little bit more punky. Bob got a short haircut or something, and we decided we were going to jump in on that whole scene. We added in kind of the power pop formula that we all kind of liked, you know, rock and roll with more of a heavy pop sound crafted to it, and combined it a little bit with a lot of the punky elements that were going on at the time. And that's kind of how the band came together. And then, of course, playing with other bands in the Boston scene at the time, you pick up lots of tricks and directions and styles and all of that from other bands in the scene at the time. So all of that, you know, played a big part of influencing what our sound was. I think it was a couple of years, maybe a year, of doing 8-track demos at a little place in Wayland when we finally caught the attention of Wayne Wadhams, who was a producer and who had had a couple of hits of his own in the 60s with a band called The Fifth Estate. He liked some of the tunes and decided he wanted to put together an LP, actually a single at first. So we recorded a single that was number one in Boston called Tune In To Me, which is the first track on the second side of the LP. Decided on the success of that to make a complete record. And so instead of using the 8-track demos, Wayne Wadhams wanted to re-record them at Studio B, which was a better class studio. So we put together the rest of the record there. And that came out, I think, in early 81. So we went down for a bunch of showcases in Boston. I'm sorry, in New York for Arista and a couple of other labels. Just about that same time, our drummer, Grant Clark, who I'm still working with and having fun with, we're doing some recordings, had just finished his law degree and decided that he was going to break off and go do that. So that kind of unraveled things for us, you know, right as we were trying to take the next step. So that was the beginning of the end of Hot Dates. But, you know, for a good 4 years, we were, you know, crafting music and, you know, doing demos and putting together, you know, the next recordings and all of that. And, you know, pretty vital part of the Boston scene, probably for 3.5 years. So that's kind of the whole story in a quick nutshell there.
Yeah. How did those comedy shows work? Was it a mix of stand up and the band? Was there kind of a theme?
It was insane, really. The guy left us carte blanche to do whatever we saw fit. So we were doing our regular tunes you know, we had worked up before the Hot Dates really started to build their repertoire. So these were tunes that Bob Millette and Grant and I had been working on. And we just brought them to these other two guys, Mitch and Sam, and, you know, had them, you know, replicate what we had done in the studio. So we went in with that as the musical piece and played as a five-piece band. And Stephen Wright and a guy named John Tenike, who also had graduated from Newbury. Is that the name of the college? That doesn't sound right, but it's, yeah, maybe it is, because it's what was right near Newbury Street. So they were there coming up and doing some of their random skits in between songs, you know, as we'd be rearranging or getting another instrument out or something. So it was very loosely concocted, and, you know, we'd say, okay, we'll do this song and we'll wear ridiculous costumes and we'll have guys in gorilla suits running around with axes and, you know, lots of ridiculous stuff. Just, you know, for really cheap and burlesque kind of entertainment. And we had dancing girls and singing girls, and we had all of that stuff going on. So it was more like a burlesque thing that was very loosely structured, where everybody said, oh, I can do this, I'll do this. And nobody was really crafting anything meaningful. It was a really bizarre thing. Nobody had figured out what they were doing yet. It was just an opportunity to perform in front of a bunch of people. So we did it, I think, twice, and that was that. And we went our separate ways. Stephen Wright went off to the rest of the Boston comedy scene that was building at that time. And I think he went on to the Carson Show in 81 or 82. So about the time that the Hot Dates were about to be signed, he and others from the Boston comedy scene were finally getting recognition on national television. That was how that came to pass.
Yeah, it's funny when you said Stephen Wright had just graduated. I was like, did he already seem like an old man? Was Stephen Wright ever young? Because it seems like he never was, you know?
Yeah, that's totally a shtick.
He's
a very normal guy. He hadn't figured out that shtick yet. He was he and John Tenike, actually John was more of a go-getter and was kind of guiding things at the time. But I think, you know, Stephen off on his own finally lit on this thing of deadpan absurdist jokes, you know, were a thing that would identify him uniquely. And so he did that. And by the time somebody from the Carson Show came and viewed the comics that were there in Boston, he kind of stood out because he figured that thing that was kind of a long shot, but it paid off in the end big time for him, you know?
Yeah.
But
But yeah, before that, he was talking like you and I, and hadn't even lit on the fact of using absurdist jokes. He was doing, you know, more physical kind of humor and trying all different sorts of things. And he was very talented and fun to work with, but he had definitely not gotten anywhere as close to that comatose figure that he plays. You know?
Wow. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. So who were some of the other bands, like the Real Kids? Were the Real Kids still around when you were on
yeah.
the scene?
Yeah, they were there.
And the Rings?
Yeah, the Real Kids. The Rings, they were really good friends of ours.
Yeah.
We played about early gigs with them. And Mike Baker, in particular, was a good friend of mine. And we actually picked up, you know, stole different bits and pieces from each other. One of my more popular tunes, Shut Up, was popular live, was actually a riff that I clipped from them, from one of his songs. Just that rhythmical, da-de-do-de-do, that kind of a rhythm, you know, so I just picked that up and wrote the song off of it. All of us were playing on the coattails of the Cars.
Right.
As soon as the Cars took off, they were Captain Swing just before before they signed. They got David Robinson, who I think played with, I've forgotten the name of the other
Modern Lovers band. He was in.
Yeah, Modern Lovers, that's right. Yeah. And we actually picked up the drummer that was in Captain Swing before David Robinson took over.
Oh, wow.
When Grant Clark left us in 82, we got Glenn Evans to drum with us so that we could finish some of our other showcases for the record companies and all. And yeah, it was a great scene, and you know, lots of little friendships or competitional friendships in the dressing rooms and all of that. And always a good crowd. I remember the first time we played, I think it was the end of July in 78, we played at the Rathskeller or the Rat in Kenmore Square. You know, we went down not really knowing what to expect, although we'd been there to see some bands previously. It was always a cool scene. But the Dead Boys, I think it was, were there.
Oh, and, man.
Peter Wolf from Jay Giles was there. And the Fenway had just, the Red Sox had just finished a game. So all these people just dumped into it. It was, you know, elbow to elbow, packed. And, you know, the scene was just ridiculously rich and, you know, full. And so it was such a blast to play. And it was always really crazy. Everybody was still using the giant amps, you know, so you had some of the double stack amps and big drum sets. And at the Rat, you'd have three bands each night, and each band would play three sets, but they didn't play two sets in a row. They broke down the whole stage and brought up another whole band. So, and it was everything. There was no back line. It was drums, amps, and Granny, the sound person at the time, would just throw, you know, SM58s or 57s up in front of the amps as if they needed sound reinforcement. And, you know, look back to the board and off you went. And it was just, you know, a din of loud, loud, loud guitar and drum music with muffled vocals. And but it was a blast.
Yeah.
It was crazy. It was really crazy. I was laughing with Johnny A a couple of years ago about it, that, you know, how we used to drag the giant amps up between 30-minute sets, you know, because the next band would go up, and, you know, nobody had any common sense about, you know, how much sound was needed. It was all, this is just what you do. You got to have a big amp. You got to, you know, crank it, you know, to 11 and play it, you know, the top decibel that you could. And it was just totally insane, but everybody did it the same way. So,
yeah.
And it was kind of cool. I think that summer the Police had come through. So, on the jukebox was, our first single, I Can't Stay, that we had just finished, as well as the Police's first record. What was it now? The Roxanne,
mm-hmm.
and Elvis Costello. So it was really cool and exciting. And you know, a lot of the early acts from England were coming through the Rat and the Paradise in Boston, and you know, they were just starting out as well. So nobody had really made it yet. Some of them were on record labels with, you know, very limited tour support, but it was a wild scene. And I would say there was probably 20 or 30 different bands that all got record contracts from 78 to 80 on national labels that, you know, had a record out and then it died, and the next one would come out, and occasionally, you know, somebody would you know, take off. I think it was Till Tuesday, you know, made it big, and Del Fuego's, and there's a bunch of them that, you know, had some staying power. Anyways, it was big fun. Yeah.
So the Hot Dates record is just great. I mean, it's such a great power pop record. It sounds great, and the songs are great, and yeah, it's just, I've interviewed more than 20 people so far now, and but one thing I really wanted to do, I'm trying to make a series of episodes, kind of tracing the evolution of power pop, maybe something like that, but
mm-hmm.
One thing I really wanted to do is talk to people from some of my favorite records that whenever you see some list of the best power pop or somebody writes a book about power pop, the ones that it always pisses me off that they're not mentioned, you know? And Hot Dates is definitely one that I would put on my list of one of the best power pop records.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. That it was... I remember at the time, Rick Cassick from The Cars was at a show, I think, in St. Louis. And I have a cousin that was younger than me by maybe 10 years and a good-looking young blonde lady. And she was, you know, trying to meet rock stars and do hairdos and working for Chanel and, you know, doing a little modeling and stuff like that. Anyway, she managed to get backstage to see Rick. And he had just come, they had just come out with, I've forgotten the name of the record, but it had Shake It Up or something on it. Maybe that was an indie
record. Yeah, that's the name of that record,
Okay, yeah. And that was out at the same time that the Hot Dates record was out. And so in, when she met him, she says, oh, I got a cousin from Boston, Jeff Root. And he says, oh, I know Jeff. And he says, he's got a great record out. So, that, you know, that was something I always remember that, you know, he wouldn't have told me that in the club when I saw him. He was hanging out with B.B. Buell at the time. And, you know, she played at a couple of the clubs that we were playing at, and he was there. And then I got backstage to talk with he and the rest of the guys at the Hartford Civic Center. But, you know, you never really complimented a competing guy, you know, directly. It was always, you know, something that you heard, you know, through the grapevine or something. But yeah. Anyways, that was a big thrill, I remember, at the time. It was a lot of fun, and it was certainly a lot of fun crafting the tunes and arranging them with those guys. One great thing that was added to us was Wayne Wadhams came in with that whole producer's ear, like the George Martin kind of guy. We arranged a few of the tunes that were a little bit looser. Mm-hmm. One of them in particular was Do You Want Me, which was written by my friend Bob Millett. And when we originally came in with our demo, I forget the exact way that it was, but it didn't start with something that was as strong as what we ended up with on the record. It was maybe more of a like a drum intro with a keyboard thing that was kind of interesting, but it didn't hit you over the head. And so he said, well, why don't you take this section and put this here and put this one over here? And so he rearranged it into something that, you know, really worked well. And he did that with several of them. You know, it was greatly appreciated. He also helped the keyboard guy and the soloist, you know, define something that would be a little bit more stringent or, you know, fitting into the arrangement a little bit tighter. And he got everybody thinking that way. So whether... You know, at first, like, he was like making these obvious suggestions and we would just do it. But after we understood what he was saying, then we started going, you know, and before we got to the studio, we'd be doing that kind of thinking on it. You know, like, you know, what if we started it with something that, you know, really hit you over the head and grabbed you versus starting with a verse, you know, let's start with a chorus or something like that. So he was... a great influence and a great collaborator. And some of the other thing is we went in with a couple of demos that we had done at his studio, and that's where we actually heard it. We heard one of our tunes called Moonlighter. Thought, oh, that's great. That's a great record, a great song or whatever. That was one of the ones that he also decided he wanted to fix up. I think that one, instead of re-recording it, he wanted to fix it up. So he actually went in with a razor blade and found where there was like, there needed to be a quarter of an inch taken out of the whole tape in order to tighten something up where, you know, we were coming in a little bit looser on the downbeat of a particular measure. He'd actually go in with a razor blade and make an edit and just tighten the whole thing up. And he was very rhythm conscious. So, you know, when we would actually be recording things from scratch, he'd be in the standing in the middle of the studio, clapping his hands to, you know, just make sure that we were being conducted, so to speak, so that we weren't straying off the rhythm and, you know, those kind of things. And also a couple of really cool sonic tricks he did, like George Martin would do with equalization on a piano part to make it really stand out and actually not sound like a piano, but sound like some synthesized thing by, you know, bringing up 5K frequency and killing everything else. And all of a sudden it sounded like, wow, that's a really cool synth sound, but it was just him playing the piano. You know? So
yeah.
Anyways, that was the other part, as he was a big factor on the production of that record and why it came out sounding so polished and professional. If you had heard the demos of some of those songs previously, you would have said, wow, they get a lot of promise, but it wouldn't have hit you over the head and impressed you as much, you know?
So, yeah, it seems like you were really lucky to have such a good producer. And you must have had a really small budget to make the record. What was Boston Skyline? What was that record label?
That was actually his record label.
Okay.
He had, Boston Skyline, and there was another name. He had two labels, and I've forgotten the name of the other one. He passed away in 2008, but he and I stayed in touch all the years between 82 and 2008. You know, still talked possibilities and ways to shop things and stuff like that. He was also, since he'd had some success in the past, he knew people in the business. And so he knew publishers and A&R people and all of that. So not only was he an excellent producer, but he was a great sort of business manager for us at the time. And we sort of used him like that for a while. But anyways, yeah, that was, he was definitely a big part of why that record and why our single came out so great.
Yeah. So, it's funny the way that Boston Skyline is written on the album cover. It makes it seem like it's the album title.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Especially with the picture on the cover, don't you have a skyline behind you. So that even makes it more seem more like that's the album title.
Yeah, my wife took that picture and the picture from the single. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's also a skyline kind of picture. The one on the album was taken in the north end looking towards, you know, the big buildings and all of that in Copley Square. So my drummer Grant and his girlfriend at the time had an apartment someplace in the north end, and we just went up to the roof and posed with the skyline behind us. And so there was no, in those days, you know, you didn't do as much doctoring or anything like that. I think the only thing we did was the high contrast development of that particular film so that it would, you know, look stark and dramatic, you know, whatever.
Yeah, the record is a great mix because you've got, I mean, some of these songs are absolutely classic power pop songs, like The Heart of You, Until She Goes. Those are just, those stand right up with anything else from the genre to me. But then you've got like I Must Fight and Shut Up that you've mentioned, which are, you know, more like punky kind of songs. They're also great, but they're so it's a great mix to it. So, you know, just all the way through the record, it almost feels like one long song, but it, you know, in a great way. It's like there's no skippable track, you know. It's a really quality album.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. That's great. Yeah, the I Must Fight was written by my friend Bob. He and I were trying to do that Lennon McCartney thing where we put our name on all the songs. Mm-hmm. And I think we actually co-wrote Tune In to Me, but the others, most of them on that particular record were mine, I think six of them. And I Must Fight was Bob's, and The Thrill I Need and Do You Want Me were his. And the rest were mine at the time. Except Tune In to Me was a co-write. Yeah, thank you very much. I really appreciate your interest and your good words, and hopefully I've given you enough information.
She's around, and I love that till she goes. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.